Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned the innocent-looking starfish is a surprisingly brutal predator.
It's morning, everyone! Today's the day! The sun is shining, the tank is clean, and we are getting out of...
The tank is clean.
The starfish is actually not a fish, which is why marine scientists have replaced that common name with the more accurate sea star. Or if we want to get formal about it, you may call it the Asterius forbesii, but that is a mouthful. The sea star is an echinoderm, more closely related to sea urchins, sand dollars, and sea cucumbers. When you were a kid visiting the aquarium, you probably rubbed your finger along its rough, bumpy skin. Or maybe you turned it over and saw all of its tiny, tubed feet moving around as though conducting its own stadium wave. Sea stars, with their pleasing and familiar shape, and the fact that they won't nip or bite back, are one of the more approachable, pet-like creatures from under the sea. But like so many of those creatures, they have fantastically interesting, kind of gross, and definitely intimidating predatory instincts that betray their innocent exterior. Sea stars prey on shellfish, generally mussels, clams, oysters, that sort of thing. They use the little suctions on their tube feet to move around and feed. They actually do have eyes on the end of each arm, which can detect light, but not color. But they find their prey through their sense of smell. Once it's found something to eat, the sea star will straddle its victim, using the power of its suction to pry the clam open. What it wants, of course, is inside. But it has another tool on its five-armed belt. A powerful digestive fluid that it spits into the gap of its victim's shell, basically weakening it and allowing the sea star to dive in. But it doesn't reach an arm in, ice cream scoop style. Instead, and this is where the gross part comes in, it will push its entire stomach out of its body and into that open shell, secreting enough digestive enzymes to basically liquefy the victim's soft body tissue. The sea star's stomach then simply mops it up, absorbing the liquid like a good rag. And sea stars do this constantly. They feed all the time. In fact, if you see a particularly large sea star, that means it has a very healthy appetite. Size is related to how much it eats, not its age. And if sea star populations grow too large, which can happen easily since they can regenerate if they split, they can wipe out entire beds of shellfish. Now, in the grand scheme of the marine ecosystem, this is not necessarily a bad thing, but the sea star appetite does compete directly with commercial fishermen who want those shellfish for sale. One sea star can devour more than 50 young clams in a week. But I mean, when a sea star is hungry, it's gotta eat, or liquefy its meal and sop it up. This week I learned that the color yellow on the Cheerios box is still up for grabs if you're hoping to trademark it.
It's no secret. Big G, little O, go with Cheerios!
But as the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board ruled recently, the color has to be associated with the product itself and not the package that the product comes in. Sorry, Cheerios. This is actually Cheerios, or rather its parent company, General Mills, second attempt to trademark the sunshine yellow on its Cheerios box. Both attempts have failed because those little round toasted oats are not sunshine yellow. The board helpfully pointed out that the bright yellow color isn't actually uniform across the Cheerios brand boxes anyway. Honey Nut has this lovely burnt orange ombre effect on its box, Frosted Cheerios is blue, and Chocolate Cheerios are milk chocolate brown, and on and on. And yellow, it turns out, is a popular color choice for cereal across the board, from Kellogg's Corn Pops to Post's Honeycomb. Even if Cheerios were to one day succeed in this trademark war, that doesn't mean it owns the particular hue of yellow outright. There are plenty of colors that are trademarked by companies. Tiffany Blue, Post-it Yellow, Louis Vuitton Red, Coca-Cola Red, UPS Brown, Barbie Pink, to name a few. That does not mean you can't use these colors ever again. The trademark extends within the industry of that product. So another toy company, for example, could get sued if it used Barbie Pink. But you can by all means paint your room that color. One of the more bitter color trademark wars has been between the candy companies Nestle and Cadbury. They have been battling for more than a decade for the exclusive rights to a particular shade of royal purple, also known as Pantone 2685C. Cadbury has been using that purple hue since 1914, but the company didn't trademark the color until 2004. Meanwhile, Nestle, the makers of the Willy Wonka brand of confection, had been wrapping their candy bars in that similar purple hue since the early aughts. When Cadbury went for the trademark, Nestle fired back with a decades-long deluge of hearings and appeals until finally, in October 2013, Nestle prevailed and Cadbury lost its trademark rights to the use of Pantone 2685C. But it did not end there. Later, when Nestle wanted to trademark the forefinger shape of its Kit Kat bar, Cadbury saw an opportunity for revenge. The British candy company objected in the UK Court of Appeal. Cadbury argued that Kit Kat was not the only bar to have fingers. Cadbury has not only a short and stumpy breakaway chocolate variety, but its parent company, Mondelez, also happens to own an obscure Norwegian chocolate bar called Kvikk Lunch, which looks identical to the Kit Kat.
Melkesjokolade har nå fått litt Kvikk Lunch I seg. Deilig Freia melkesjokolade.
The court eventually decided that the shape of the chocolate was not distinct enough to warrant a trademark, which means in this bitter chocolate battle, the score is now tied. This week I learned that tropical fish can get hooked on opioids just like humans. And as weird as it may sound, this oceanic drug problem could actually help us understand our own opioid addiction. In a study out of the University of Utah, researchers trained tropical zebrafish to get hooked on the drug hydrocodone. The way that worked is every time the fish swam over to a shallow platform, they would trigger the automatic release of hydrocodone into the water. But the drug quickly filtered out of the tank, so if the fish wanted to maintain their high, they had to keep going back to the platform to instigate the drug release. The thing is, tropical fish normally avoid shallow water where they're easily targeted by predators. But not these drug-addled fish. After just 5 days, the fish were visiting the opioid delivering platform almost 2,000 times every 50 minutes. And then the researchers made it even harder to get the drug, requiring more than one visit at a time to get a hit. And the fish rose to the challenge, returning as many as 20 times for just one dose. They were hooked. Previous studies had shown that zebrafish exposed to opioids exhibited symptoms of withdrawal, like anxiety and stress. But this is the first study to show that the fish would expend effort and even risk their lives for a hit of the drug. Now, the reason that researchers are getting these poor fish hooked on drugs is that zebrafish and humans have similar physiological and genetic makeup. We share the same opioid receptors in the brain and the same pleasure and reward neurotransmitters. So researchers hope to apply their findings from this study to humans to develop a new therapy drug, but one that wouldn't use another opioid in the place of the first addiction. This week I learned how surgeons were able to remove a tumor from a musician's brain that had been embedded in the region connected to his musical function. This is a crazy story. It starts with a music teacher named Dan Fabio. At the age of 25, Dan found out that he had a mass in his brain. The good news was that it was benign, and it was in an area of the brain that was relatively easy to access for surgeons. The bad news was that this area of the brain was known to be important for musical function. And music was Dan's whole life. He didn't want to lose that. So neurosurgeons at the University of Rochester developed a plan. They would map Dan's brain so that they knew exactly which parts were critical to Dan's musical abilities. Because both the tumor and the operation to remove it can damage tissue and disrupt communication between different parts of the brain. And while everyone's brain is technically organized more or less the same, there can be important nuances on a granular level that can completely change the way the brain functions from one person to another. So a brain scan allowed the doctors to perform basically a detailed investigation into Dan's brain. The way they created this map was they hooked Dan up to brain scanning technology, and then they brought in a musical theorist who helped develop a series of cognitive musical tests that Dan would perform while the researchers were scanning his brain. At times, Dan would listen to music and then hum back a series of melodies. At other times, Dan had to identify objects and repeat sentences. With these tests, the brains were able to detect the areas that were important for music and language processing. With that information, a research team built a highly detailed 3D map of Dan's brain that would basically act as a guide to surgeons during the operation. And then this story gets really interesting. Dan was awake during the surgery. Literally, while the surgeons were cutting into his brain, Dan would go through those musical tests, the humming and language repeat back stuff. And the musical theorist was there too, in the operating room, gauging Dan's abilities as they were slicing and removing. But it wasn't just Dan's ability to process and relate music that was important to measure. The team also wanted to make sure that Dan's ability to perform music was still intact. So they decided to bring his saxophone into the operating room and have him play it. As you might be able to imagine, this was a huge risk. For one, Dan was lying on his side, which makes it very hard to play in the first place. And for two, the pressure caused by the deep breaths that Dan would need to play the saxophone could essentially cause his exposed brain to protrude from the skull. In the end, Dan selected a simpler, quieter piece, a Korean folk song, which he could play with shorter and shallower breaths. When the tumor was removed, with Dan still on the operating table, brain open to the world, doctors handed Dan his saxophone. And he played the song flawlessly. When he finished, the entire operating room erupted into applause. Dan has since made a full recovery and is back teaching music. And the brain mapping information has helped scientists better understand the complexity of the brain's structure and function. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can check out theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any fascinating scientific tidbits, new studies, or historic revelations that you'd like to share, email me. You can reach me at podcasts@theweek.com. Both singular and plural will get you there. Just put podcasts in the subject. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 risk-free issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.